Well, howdy, neighbors. Good afternoon. We're glad that we're going to be able to be with you for the next few minutes as we talk about the issue of trade. It's been a busy day already as far as agriculture is concerned. We report, of course, about agricultural things going on for both our farmers as well as our ranchers in Oklahoma and our surrounding states as well. As we do that, we're always interested in what is going on. A couple of things that's happened, even as you've been meeting this morning, the GMO labeling compromise from the Senate has passed the House of Representatives. And along the way, it looks like it will now be signed into law by the president very, very soon. That will preempt the New England law, the Vermont law, here in the very, very near future. That's caused so much heartburn across the country for a lot of our food companies. And, of course, a lot of our agricultural groups have been very, very interested in that. Along the way, also today, very interesting to note that our GOP presumptive nominee for president, Donald Trump, has made his announcement known in regards to the vice presidential running mate. You may have already seen on Facebook or Twitter or one of your telephone feeds, app feeds, that he has selected Governor Mike Pence from the state of Indiana. Interesting to note that Governor Pence is a former member of the House Agriculture Committee. And so good to see somebody that maybe actually knows a little bit about agriculture. I actually had the chance to visit with Colin Woodall just a few minutes ago about that. He says it's had a good working relationship with Congressman Pence at that time. The word that we're getting from our broadcasters in Indiana are that he's got a good handle on agriculture as governor, and he's a proponent of trade. So that may be interesting, some of the conversations he will have with Donald Trump along the way regarding trade. So we'll get into that here a little bit later on. Guys, if y'all come on up right now, that will kind of segue us into our panel. You can kind of see their mug shots up here. I'm not sure if any of these are on post office walls anywhere in the country or not, but we'll be checking that. I'm going to go ahead and let each of these gentlemen introduce themselves real quickly. And as we do that, they'll tell you just a little bit about themselves, and then we'll get on into some of the business this afternoon of trying to set the stage for this conversation about trade. So, Thad, I'll let you start.
Okay, thank you, Ron. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Thad Lively. I work for the U.S. Meat Export Federation here in Denver. I have spent my entire career, in fact, working on agriculture trade, starting out originally at USDA in Washington and then working for them overseas as well. And I've spent the better part of the last 20 years here at USMEF. So really appreciate being included in this panel and look forward to talking about where we are with beef exports.
Bill Westman, Bill. North American Meat Institute. Thank you very much for the invitation this afternoon to the organizers. It's a pleasure to be here. As you may know, the Meat Institute represents what you would think as traditional meat packers, but we also represent the companies that build slaughter plants, build processing facilities, and so forth. So we have diverse interests. Our goal is to promote trade in meat and poultry products, so we work on exports as well as imports. I also had a career at USDA with the Foreign Ag Service. My last posting was in Beijing, China, and from there I went to work for then called AMI. One shout out, our chief meat scientist is here, Dr. Betsy Boreen. She'll be on your program later, so I'm not here by myself.
Okay, very good. Any questions you've got that you can't handle, she'll handle.
She'll handle them. Okay. She's already agreed to take them on.
Very good. We'll get a microphone to her as well. Kent?
Well, thanks, Ron. I'm Kent Backus. I'm Director of International Trade and Market Access for NCBA. And Ron, it looks like you're the only one that got a good picture up on the screen today. The rest of us got some driver's license pictures, but let's hope the conversation is a little more lively than that.
We'll try. Yeah. All right. Okay, very good. Gentlemen, thank you all very much. Before we turn to them and start talking about some of the issues of trade, wanted to kind of set the stage, give a little bit of context. And, you know, it's important for us to understand where we've been, where we are today, as well as looking ahead. And trade is a very forward-looking part of our industry. And if we look at where we've been, how many of you all remember where you were December 23rd, 2003? Anybody remember that? Remember the sinking feeling that you had in your stomach for that entire weekend? You don't know if your cattle were worth anything or not at all. That was the day, and some of the various officials within the cattle industry got the word a little bit earlier, but the media, we got the word later in the afternoon. I remember very well, I was out shopping with my wife. It was the day before Christmas, of course. And as we were shopping, a dear friend of mine called and said, "Ron, have you heard the news? Have you heard that there's going to be a special teleconference coming up in just a little while?" And so traded information about that, got back to the studio, got the old reel-to-reel tape recorder rolling, and we recorded the words of then Secretary of Agriculture Ann Veneman. We started learning things like presumptive positive as they talked about this cow from the state of Washington, a Canadian cow that was tested presumptive positive for BSE, bovine spongiform encephalopathy. The media, of course, loves to call that mad cow. And really, truly, when we start thinking about things, it is the kind of the demarcation line when it comes to this whole idea of trade in this country. When we start thinking about some of the things that we've got going on today in the world of agriculture, if you look at this graph, you can kind of see all the various little lines. But you'll notice that midway through, there's a 2003 up there. And if you take a look at that 2003, it was a pretty good year for beef exports. Not so in 2004. It fell off the edge of the earth. And as it did that, we had to start over on a country-by-country basis, rebuilding our U.S. beef trade because of that cow that came from Canada and that was associated with our U.S. cattle industry. And we still are paying the price today in some countries, in some situations, most notably our friends in China have still not quite gotten over the cow that stole Christmas. So with that in mind, a couple of the countries that kind of stayed with us early on, and we were able to build from there, our friends from Canada, our friends from Mexico, and along that same general time frame, we got into the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. We've heard some talk about NAFTA in the presidential campaign. You may have noticed that one of our presidential candidates has decided that he doesn't like NAFTA. He wants to redo the deal or get us out of NAFTA somehow. Guys, you know, when we think about that, let's talk about, because this is a good way to kind of establish the baseline, has this particular trade deal, NAFTA, been good for U.S. cattle producers?
Well, I'd say, Ron, without a doubt, undeniably, it's been good for the beef industry in this country. Our exports to Mexico have grown something like 300% since the NAFTA agreement was signed. It is today our biggest export market. We export over $1 billion a year worth of beef and beef variety meats to Canada. Obviously, Canada also sends an awful lot of live cattle north to the United States, which is something that our industry has become very dependent on. So looked at from a beef industry perspective, I think it would be hard to make an argument against NAFTA. I don't know what you guys have.
Well, I think that what we've seen is what we would call the integration of the North American meat market. And what we're working on is we're trying to facilitate trade within the region to the benefit of producers and packer community as well as consumers, because really the idea is to not harmonize but converge the rules and regulations so that we can facilitate production and make it better for everybody.
How would you even back out of NAFTA, you know, this many years into it, Kent?
I think when you need to look at, just as Bill mentioned, the integration that we have, there's a lot of cross-border investment that we have benefited from. So it'd be very difficult, legally, you'd have to go through the process, and we would have to face some potential WTO lawsuits and things like that. But I think just fundamentally it'd be very difficult because we would lose all the advantages that we have. You're talking about bringing in fed cattle from Canada, bringing in calves over from Mexico, putting U.S. investment into them, and then reaping the benefits of that investment. But I think we'd also lose a lot of access on the beef export side, because when you look at the populations and the infrastructure of both Canada and Mexico, we are at a strategic advantage. When in Canada, it's roughly 80 to 85% of their production is in Alberta. Most of their population are on the coast or closer to the U.S. border in Mexico. They don't have the same infrastructure to be able to supply that food year-round. But we have been able to capitalize on that. Because of that, we have two $1 billion markets on either side of the border. So I think it's pretty dangerous just to make those kind of claims just to score some political points.
They have a lot more to lose.
Right, right. No doubt about that. No doubt about that. But, you know, when we think about the NAFTA agreement, that's kind of a nice precursor to jump in to the trade potentially with the Pacific Rim. And these are markets that we had to work on down through the years to regain. And we've done that to, at least to some level. But the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we're going to spend a good bit of time on that today, folks. And I know this is an educated audience. They understand the value of TPP, but I thought we'd at least talk about that just for a few moments. How valuable, if we get it approved, will TPP be to the U.S. cattle producer and our beef industry?
Maybe just to offer a personal perspective, I personally never thought we'd be in a position to have a trade negotiation with Japan that would permit us to bring down our tariffs that we pay on product going into Japan. That just felt like something that would never happen. And because of TPP, it has happened. And our government, I think, has done a very good job of negotiating beef access to Japan. We're going to be looking at a market that is already our highest value market, the one that's worth the most to the industry year in and year out. It's got huge potential, upside potential for growth. And you take away that tax that every pound of beef pays going into the market. You drop that from where it is today at 38.5% of the value of the product down to 9% over 15 years. That's going to make a huge difference. I mean, consumers are going to respond, and you're going to see at the level of individual Japanese consumers, they're going to eat more beef, and it's going to be U.S. beef. So Japan, of course, was our focus in the TPP negotiation. We already had free trade agreements with most or half of the countries that are involved. The big, you know, opportunity in TPP was in Japan.
Right. I think we need to recognize that with the basically failure of the WTO negotiations and the whole format, these regional agreements have become very important. And when negotiating with this Pacific Rim, we're not the only player in the market. So we face stiff competition there, as we can see, seeing what has happened with Australia and Japan and what we face there. And we are at a significant tariff disadvantage as this gets delayed and delayed and delayed in getting approval.
And Kent has done some analysis of this, too.
And I definitely think that, it's as Bill mentioned, we're not the only ones competing for the Japanese market. The EU is next in line with the FTA ready to go with Japan. Canada stands ready to move forward with bilateral talks, as New Zealand as well. So if we don't take advantage of this, we're going to lose a very important opportunity there. But it's not just about what we're going to get from Japan. We have opportunities in some of the other countries as well. But the leverage we're going to have on future additions to TPP, if we miss this opportunity, well, we may not likely ever have the same opportunity again. When you look at countries like Taiwan, Indonesia, the Philippines, all countries with growing middle-class markets who want more beef as part of their diet, we need that access. And TPP will give us the leverage to take down all those barriers that prevent us from meeting our potential and competing on a level playing field in those markets.
Now, perfect world, Congress would hear this and say, how quick can I vote yes? Unfortunately, that doesn't quite happen when it comes to the land of the brave and the home of the free with our political campaigns going on today. What's the political atmosphere right now, Ken?
I think it's important to understand that this is a political year. This is a campaign year, and you have the entire House of Representatives, a third of the U.S. Senate, and the White House at play. And every time this comes up, every time you have this opportunity, there's always a political hot-button issue. Unfortunately, trade's in the crosshairs right now. And so it's easy to score some cheap points, some political points, by making some unsubstantiated, unsupported claims about trade. But I think what we're seeing is that
the incumbents are in a survival mode right now. They don't want to come out and take a position in support of trade because they're afraid they're going to get attacked. If you're a Republican, you're going to get attacked from the Tea Party by saying that you're in line with President Obama. If you're coming out in support of trade as a Democrat, the labor unions are going to come hit you on this. So there's not a really comfortable landing zone, which is why I think it's probably more likely we're not going to see any movement until after the election. But that means that our movement and all of our efforts have to be in place right now because we can't afford to wait until that six-week period after the elections.
Can you respond to these ads on the screen? These are a couple of ads that have been seen, in the Washington area?
Yes, yeah, so NCBA and some of our allies, we have placed a lot of investment in media buys in the Washington market. And in D.C., people do look at ads that are taken out. The staff, the elected officials, they do pay attention. These are ads that have been run in Roll Call, in The Hill, Politico, and some places like that, some of the more well-known Washington newspapers. But the message is very simple, that every day that we don't have TPP, we're at a disadvantage. And ultimately, in big, bold letters, that if we fail to lead on all the trade negotiations in the Pacific, then China is going to take over. China's already there. China's already negotiating these trade deals. And if we do not take advantage of the opportunity at hand, then we're going to give up a lot of the advantage that we have now. But also, we're going to basically cede our sphere of influence in the Pacific to the Chinese.
Well, and our competitors have been very aggressive.
That's right.
In that region, Australia, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, they're not waiting around for TPP to get passed.
No, I agree. I think that's the real point. We sometimes we forget we're operating in an extremely competitive environment out in the world. And the world hadn't stopped, as Bill says, to wait to see what happens with this vote in Congress or when the vote in Congress happens. If this kind of goes back to your question, Ron, about pulling out of NAFTA. I mean, what does that say to the rest of the world, not only about our commitment to trade and openness and trade liberalization, but what does that say about us as a country and somebody you can negotiate with and somebody you can count on? And TPP is something that we drove to its conclusion at the negotiating stage. If the other 11 countries realize that this whole thing's going to fall apart with all the political capital they've invested, et cetera, because the United States has an election, that sends the wrong message, I think, out to the world. So it is a competitive environment. TPP is not going to prevent other countries from actively going into those markets that are so critical, as Kent says, in Asia, those growing markets, in negotiating their own free trade agreements. And we'll be left behind.
And Ron, just to kind of bring it home, too, I mean, as we've said, this is a political year. This is a very direct message because we have to speak directly to these politicians. Your elected officials will always take the path of least resistance. If they think they can get by with something without any repercussions, then they're going to take that path. It's hard to take a firm stand on something and get enough people to do it because, I mean, let's just face it, politically, this is survival mode right now. So they need to know how important this is to us. And that this is not an option. This is not something that we're going to give a free pass on. This is an issue that they either have to support us on or they need to find someone else to support them. And that's a message we're going to continue to deliver throughout the rest of the year until we get this enacted into law.
You're saying our Congress takes the path of least resistance?
Unfortunately, yes.
Now, speaking of least resistance, we're about 24 hours away from the congressional recess. How hot is it right now in Washington?
It's very hot.
So they're going to get out of town, go back to your hometowns, and we'll talk a little bit more in a little bit about the opportunity you'll have during town hall meetings and other political events over the next few weeks. You're going to have a chance to look these guys straight in the eye, these guys and these ladies, and say, we need TPP. So we'll talk about here a little bit more about that as we come back around toward the end. One other thing from these ads I want to point out to you, and I talked to Phil Tsang this morning, did an interview with him in our media room. $367,000 is what the cattle industry loses. Not a month, not a week, every single day. And that is the difference between the tariff advantage that the Australians have versus us. Is that right, Thad?
That's right. That's right.
So amazing. So
Australia already negotiated an agreement with Japan, so they've already got better terms, lower tariffs that they're paying today. And as Kent says, and as this ad very clearly lays out, every day that goes by without TPP being passed and implemented sets us back that much further.
Let's talk a little bit about maybe, let's get politics into this thing a little bit more, because the reality is we've got, I'm sorry, but, you know, the reality is we have both really presidential contenders trying to outdo each other on wanting to beat up the boogeyman known as trade. And, you know, talking about wanting to renegotiate, wanting to say no, wanting to have Congress not vote during the lame duck. All these kind of things are being talked about right now among our presidential contenders and by the parties right now. How much damage has been done to the ability of passing TPP by the presidential campaign?
Geez, I don't think so much, because it's just the way things are. And to have politicians change their mind on trade is not new. Okay, so we're hoping for that later on.
Change your mind?
Yeah. So I think that the work we do on the Hill, it's obvious, as Kent was saying, that it's everyone's waiting to see what happens with the election. But I don't think that the candidates talking anti-trade is going to change that much.
Yeah, look, this, I think it's very obvious right now that neither one of these candidates are just, you know, I put it, neither party is in love with the candidate that they have in front of them. They're dealing with what natural selection in this case has brought forward. Unfortunately, I don't know if you call that evolution, but it certainly yielded two products that were like, oh.
Some say the Darwin effect.
Yeah, exactly. So this is what we have to live with. This is what we have to deal with. And so you really don't have many politicians who are out there wrapping their arms around these candidates saying, this is going to be the solution. It's, we're better than the other solution. We're better than the other alternative. And when you have a race to the bottom like that, it's not going to get positive anytime soon. And so I don't think that we're really going to see a lot of impact, because in this case, when you have candidates who are taking these polarizing positions like that, sometimes that gives a little bit of cover to people back home to distance themselves from their party or from the incumbent. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the down ballot elections. We'll see if this is going to cost Republicans in the Senate. It could cost them potentially in the House. At the same time, there are a lot of Democrats who are not enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton. Is that going to drive them to the polls, or is the thought of Donald Trump as the president going to be the driver? So there are a lot of factors in play here, but I think that at the end of the day, it's the message that they receive from you at the grassroots level that matters the most. It's not what Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton say that they support. It's what you support, because ultimately you're the ones that elect them to that position. And that's what you need to remember, and we really need to emphasize over the next few months.
You know, we do quite a bit of work through what's called the TPP Coalition. And this is across-the-board representation from agriculture. Right. And this is what we've been talking about recently, is getting out to the states, getting out to the counties, working with our companies, employees, to reinforce the message of how important trade is to our businesses and to the bottom line. I mean, if you look back at the graph you had before, 30 years ago we exported very little beef, pork, and lamb, and turkey, and so forth, and now it's become a significant part of our business. So this is the message we're starting to deliver. Make sure they know that.
Very much so. Very much so.
I think the other thing that we see going on there, just real quickly, which isn't so much a question of partisan politics, is if you think about the last few big trade votes that have gone through our Congress, have won by one vote. So this, what we see going on is, in that respect, not that unusual. Right. To see this attention placed on trade in the political campaigns, we all know that's unusual. So there's always going to be attention there. There's always going to be essentially what we see going on every day, a negotiation between members of Congress and the Obama administration, where those members are saying, I've got to vote, and you're going to have to pay me to vote the way you want me to vote. And you know, everybody's keeping their position pretty much in the background today. But this part of the process, I'd say, is very familiar. We've seen this over and over again.
One more thing on TPP before we move on. Kent, you and I had a conversation yesterday in the media room about currency manipulation. Yeah. And I don't want to get too far down the weeds on this. we want to keep everybody awake.
Yeah.
Keep them in the room here a little bit longer. But let's talk about there are groups out there that are saying we can't support TPP because it does not address currency manipulation. And these countries are all doing us dirty, and we can't support it. Is that true?
So, you know, unfortunately, you have a lot of groups who've run out of excuses to oppose TPP, so they've brought currency manipulation, which is more of a side issue, into their arguments. And when you look at currency manipulation, we view it as a very serious issue because it does have an impact on our ability to trade on a fair and level playing field. And opponents of TPP have said that, just as Ron mentioned, because there's not a provision in the Trans-Pacific Partnership that specifically addresses all of their concerns about currency manipulation, and they can't support it. Even though there's all these benefits that are going to come for U.S. jobs, for manufacturing, agriculture, you name it, they find one issue as pretty much their scapegoat or a reason to oppose this. What they're not telling you, and maybe they're just not aware of it, is the fact that Congress has already addressed the concerns of currency manipulation. They did that through the passage of the Customs Enforcement Act at the beginning of this year. Customs Enforcement Act, among many things, it renewed expired provisions that allow USTR and USDA and other factions of our government to go after some of these bad actors. But what another thing that it did is it created a new criteria. And for the United States to enter into trade agreements with other countries, we'll now look and compare their behavior to a set of criteria to determine whether or not they're good actors or bad actors. And it's in everyone's interest to do business with the United States because we're the largest economy in the world. So it's kind of the carrot and stick approach. They need to be good actors in order to get that access to the United States. So this is something that Congress has put forward. It's something that is now law. And because of that, it's an incentive for other countries to clean up their act. So the other concern with that, and I think the important thing to remember, is why we shouldn't put this in TPP. And the main reason why is that some of those provisions that would be included that would trigger any kind of WTO action or potential retaliatory tariffs that could be triggered because of currency manipulation, or at least the presumption of currency manipulation, a lot of those would be brought against the United States. The United States, in many ways, has been accused of being a currency manipulator, and in some cases, you could argue that we have with quantitative easing and things like that. Again, not trying to get into the weeds, but...
No, it's an important point, though. But, I mean, we have a Federal Reserve Board that takes care of these things, or tries to. And the relative value of currencies move for many reasons. So we need to be careful about keeping something like this out of the trade agreement and have it be handled somewhere else. That's my personal opinion.
Yeah, because ultimately, it'd be the United States that'd be the defendant in the court, you know, 9 out of 10 times.
What is the old adage, one finger pointed out at someone, three fingers pointed back at yourself. So
it is an important issue. Yeah. It really doesn't deserve to be in TPP. It
doesn't belong there.
So as we leave and kind of wrap up our part of our conversation on Trans-Pacific Partnership, you know, one more graph that folks can take a look at right now. This kind of reflects this $367,000 a day difference between Australia and the United States, and our shipments are going to go down every day that we don't have TPP passed. What happens if we don't get it done in the lame duck? Can we do it under the context of a new administration, new Congress? I mean, what happens if it doesn't happen in November, December?
Depends.
Well, I mean, the technical answer to the question is that the president, new president, will still have the authority to send this agreement up to Congress, and Congress will have to vote up or down on it. They're not going to be able to take the agreement apart and say, we like this part, we don't like that part. So that's good news. That authority will still exist. But as Bill's answer suggests, who knows? I mean, we've got so much rhetoric.
Depends who wins.
Yeah, we've got so much rhetoric surrounding
trade. And if someone's willing to change
their
mind.
Right. I guess we'll go back to that China answer a while ago as well that we'll get into in a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about the other agreement that's out there that apparently is not going to happen in the Obama administration time frame, TTIP, our negotiations with Europe. Did all that just get blown sky high with the British vote?
I don't think TTIP was going to happen this year anyway. I think the administration was being unusually or unnaturally optimistic about that. But, you know, they set out at the beginning a very aggressive trade agenda, and this was part of it. So it's not surprising that they've continued to insist that this is going to get done. And certainly since the Brexit vote, they wanted to send the message, hey, look, we're just as committed to this as we ever were, and the Europeans wanted to do the same thing. But this is an incredibly complicated and difficult negotiation. Agriculture, as usual, is a huge part of the complexity that has to be dealt with. From what we're hearing, really, on the hard parts, very little progress has actually been made. So the idea that you're going to use the deadline of January 20 to push the Europeans into a deal that, you know, a lot of people over there are not comfortable with to begin with, I think it's unlikely. I think the effect of Brexit is that now a lot of the people in the European Commission who have to negotiate these deals, their attention is now going to be turned to how do we unwind this agreement with the UK, with Great Britain.
Right.
So, you know, the odds of this happening already were very low, and I think it probably, if anything, pushed them a little lower, Brexit, yeah.
We have some very difficult issues being negotiated, which we just don't see any progress on. I mean, you've got the non-hormone-treated cattle program, you have pathogen reduction treatments, we're not making any progress there, cloning, geographic indications. These are issues that the EU, as far as we see, are just not going to move on anytime fast, and it's this propensity to use the precautionary principle and not base rules and standards on science is something that we just can't go along with. I mean, we actually have to have that in the negotiation.
Yeah, I think the bigger concern is that we just have two almost polar opposite views of the use of science and production technology in food production. We embrace it. We see it as part of our future. We see it as an important part of not only having healthy animals, but a healthy environment. And the Europeans shun it in a lot of ways. Yeah. And it's not just that. We're going to have debates over GMOs. We're going to have debates on antibiotics and on everything else under the sun. And how do you do all of that major, major policy debates without that incentive to, you know, to conclude? There's really nothing that is a catalyst to force us to conclude negotiations. So, you know, I think we will make some progress, but, you know, I think another important curveball that also happened, as soon as the new Prime Minister of Great Britain was sworn in, within 2 hours, you already had House Republicans issuing statements calling for a bilateral free trade agreement between the United States and Great Britain. So is that going to be a priority under a new administration? And the British have already said that they're going to start seeking bilateral trade agreements with the United States, with China, with other leading economies around the world. So now we have another country that's going to be aggressively pursuing trade agreements and trying to set those high standards. So I think the momentum on TTIP is just not there right now.
Right. Let's turn our attention to the elephant in the room. The old adage of anything times a billion is a lot is kind of one of the things you hear when you start talking about China. Yeah. Are we ever going to get, in other words, I alluded to the cow that stole Christmas. We haven't really had open trade with China since that 2003 time period. Are we ever going to get across the finish line?
It depends.
I think we will. I think we will. But, you know, it can take still a very long time. The truth is the Chinese market is just blowing the doors off. Chinese beef imports so far this year are already up 63% over last year. All of the countries in the world that export beef have access to China except us, and they're all shipping there, and they're all competing very, very aggressively with one another. There is huge demand in that market, and there is definitely demand for our product. So we need to keep working away at this. This is a market we have to be in. But I think just this process of trying to get the door open, this negotiation process, I think has taught us a lot about what it's going to mean to work with the Chinese over time. It's going to be difficult. And right. There's going to be a sense at times that the bar goal line keeps moving on us. And that's part of what we've been experiencing so far.
I've heard the allusion to the fact that we get so far down the road and then suddenly they change people and we get pushed back to the start. And we go, it's kind of like Groundhog Day. Mm-hmm. As far as negotiating with the Chinese. This graph that's up on the screen right now, it's kind of hard to read the little set of countries here on the side, but there's Canada, there's Argentina, there's New Zealand, there's Australia, Uruguay, a pretty good size exporter, and Brazil, a good size exporter to China. We're not listed. So I guess that's frustrating, isn't it?
It is. It is indeed.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the frustrating things for us is, you know, in the West, you know, as Americans, we traditionally will make a checklist of things that we need to accomplish. And once they're accomplished, we move on to something else. And what we've kind of found with this negotiation with China is some of the things that have been checked off on the checklist have reemerged in a new form with new people who are there. It's also important to keep in mind that they think in a much longer time frame than we do. And so it is frustrating to an extent, but we're going to remain committed to China, especially when you consider the buying power that they have. You know, a fifth of the world's population, and the fact that their middle class, which is growing, is larger than our entire U.S. population. We'd be stupid not to try to engage with China. This is not a market that you can ignore. This is a market you have to try to engage with. You have to find some kind of entry level and then build from that. You have to build that trust again. And so that's why we'll remain committed to working on that together.
I think it's important to remember that China is a place where they'll say, we'll give you something, you give us something. Mm-hmm. So what they're waiting for is access to our poultry market officially for Chinese origin poultry. So once that happens, then I think you'll see some movement on the beef side. But until that happens, we're going to continue to see delays.
I guess what there's some external factors as far as just some of the geopolitical things that goes on.
Well, we don't have any control over that. That's always going to happen. But once we resolve this poultry issue, I think these things start to move. That's the idea. But that hasn't stopped all of us on the stage from working on this issue and working with our negotiators to try to resolve it and answer their questions.
And many of the people in this room have been involved in those conversations.
Yes, exactly. Especially the issue, which is important to everyone here, traceability. I mean, that's something we've had to deal with and come to terms with.
China's kind of at the top of our wish list as far as the countries we'd love to see to have access. What is the future? What's your vision about trade looking forward? In other words, what are our opportunities, you know, on a global basis these days?
I mean, the opportunities for this industry, in my view, are huge. You know, put simply, global demand far outstrips global supply. And as we all know, you're going to have exchange rates that move against you from time to time. We're going to go through periods like the one we're now coming out of where our beef is very expensive. This is going to affect our ability to be competitive. But these are short-term blips. I think if you look at it as a longer-term proposition, exports are going to continue to be an area of growth and profitability for this industry. I have no question about that. And I think this industry is uniquely well-positioned to provide to consumers all around the world a product that they want. The demand for our product is very clear, and they pay a premium for U.S. beef. We see that all around the world.
Does it pay dividends when producers use checkoff funds, when state, you know, commodity groups actually spend extra money into a particular country? Does that pay dividends?
Well, I can say from our perspective at USMEF, and we are fortunate to be the recipients of a lot of that support, yes. I mean, without that funding and support from producers, we wouldn't be able to do what we do. We wouldn't be able to be in the markets day in and day out, working with the customers, understanding the markets, sending that information back here, in developing strategies that are going to, in implementing strategies at the marketing level that are going to cause a growth over time. That's what checkoff funding has done for the industry, I think, quite well, and will continue to.
Plus, we have the U.S. has the reputation of producing the best quality beef with an emphasis on food safety, and this is clear in all the markets we work in around the world, especially in a place like China where they want our products. They can't. We have customers there that are anxious to get this market on. They're ready to buy, and I think that's where our niche is we produce such a high-quality product. That's not going to change. We're not going to compete with India and water buffalo meat in the Philippines, okay? That's not our market. We don't want to be in that market. We want to produce, you know, this very high-quality beef that, you know, go anywhere. People want to buy it. I can.
Yeah, look, I think it's also important to know what your competition is putting out there as far as levies and checkoffs. New Zealand, Australia, in some cases, it's close to $10 per head. With some of the Asian countries, it's even upwards of $20 per head compared to what we use. Now, we have a greater volume in many ways, so that kind of compensates there. But if we're going to continue to compete, then we're going to have to invest in promoting our product. And, yes, our product speaks for itself. When people compare our product in market, it's hard to compete with. We are going to continue to grow, and we're going to continue to try to market that as much as possible. And it's going to take a coordinated effort and a dedicated effort to continue to meet that demand.
Right. Water buffalo futures. Wow, that's kind of a concept. We could probably incorporate those in our reports. Let's circle back around now. We've got a few minutes left. Let's circle back around to TPP. That's the subject du jour. As far as the politics of the United States is concerned, it's a political animal at this point. What do we do? How do we best engage? In other words, we've got a lot of grassroots folks or folks that can influence the grassroots here in this room. How do we engage successfully with our politicians?
Wow. Well, I'll just tell you. I mean, no one can speak better than you can. The fact that these incumbents, these people who are running for office, are coming to you asking for your support. They need to earn it. We need to make sure that we have people in Congress who are going to support us, especially on trade issues. These are not easy issues, and they're going to get attacked. But they need to know that the folks who are in the ag industry, the people who are generating wealth in their districts, who are creating jobs, and in many cases, who are making a product that counters the trade deficit that we have, that this is an important issue. Trade is very important, and it's especially the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We can't afford to delay this. We have to have this vote this year. We have to enact this. And if they're not going to support us on that, then maybe we should look at supporting someone else.
And I think it's very important when you come to Washington to visit. We spend a lot of time on the Hill talking to staff and representatives and senators, but these staff members turn over frequently, and it's a re-education process all the time. And if we don't do it, someone else is going to do it, or it's going to get dropped off the table because, well, no one told me that this was important. So we're constantly there re-educating the new staff that comes in because they do turn over. And what's the life cycle of a staffer on the Hill?
Usually about 18 months to 2 years before they change offices.
It may get tedious and boring to come to Washington all the time, but it's very important that you reach out to these staff members because the representative is going to turn and say, what's this issue on TPP and Japan? Tell me about that. So that's why we have to be there all the time.
And things like what you guys are doing today in D.C., your hot dog event.
The hot dog lunch,
That's a good way to probably reach out and talk about a good
It's
good
one of the
story.
Most popular activities on the Hill.
Wow. Yeah. I'm sorry you're missing today.
Well, Barry sends his apologies. He had to be there today. He would have loved to have been here. This is the first one he's missed in a long, long time.
Very good. Well, you know, for folks that are out in the countryside, going to Washington is one option. Talking to the staffers is one option. What kind of a message? In other words, if they get 30 seconds with a candidate at a function in the home district in the month of August, what's that message? Bill?
Well, I'd say look at the companies we have working in the district. Look at what they're doing in exports, and it's not just the product being sold. We have trucking, we have packaging, we have port facilities, we have inland transportation. It affects the whole region, the whole state, right down to the town level. This is where we create jobs. This is what we need. We're not going to do it by ourselves. We need your help.
I think you just be very clear. This is TPP is not Obama's trade deal. This is our trade deal. This is about our jobs. This is about our future. And we need you to support us this year.
You know, bottom line, when it comes to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, Kent, you said it well as far as that the opportunity is now. In other words, literally the unknowns are too great to let go to 2017. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, the beef industry maybe is the biggest clear winner under TPP in any part of agriculture or any part of American industry. And there are an awful lot of interest groups out there that are working against TPP. That means we have to work that much harder. This is going to benefit the industry probably more than any trade agreement we've ever signed, because we're going to get improved access to our best market. We have to have this done, and we need to remember that there are people who feel just as strongly on the other side of the issue, and so, as these guys have been saying, politicians need to hear that over and over again. Trade's never an easy issue, but for this industry, it's a clear win.
And I think we can say the three of us have done so much work on this. We can say that, regardless of the criticism, the negotiators, and for beef at least, have done an excellent job for us. I mean, they've put together a package which really is quite remarkable. They're getting a lot of complaints from other sectors, from dairy and rice and so forth and so on. But on the beef side, we should take the deal as soon as we can, is my opinion.
Very good. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. Give our panelists a round of applause today. Thad Lively, Bill Westman, Kent Bacchus, done a great job in helping us look a little bit at some of these issues. There's, you can go a lot deeper on a lot of these subjects. There's a lot of opportunities, a lot of ways you can approach the topic of trade. But at the end of the day, it's that relationship with your lawmaker that's going to make, in this case, this particular trade deal a reality or not. Here in 2016. Tracy?